This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. When you watch a big-budget film, you may not be thinking about how China influenced the story, the characters, and the product placements, but after this interview, you'll probably be on the lookout for those things. When China started allowing in American films, opening up a huge market and big profits for Hollywood, in return, Hollywood had to make sure the films it wanted shown in China wouldn't offend the Chinese government. China exerted its power to reward and punish American studios, leading to Chinese censorship of American films and American studios self-censoring. How that's reshaped the American film industry and its big-budget movies is the subject of the new book Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. My guest is the author Eric Schwartzel. He reports on the film industry for The Wall Street Journal. Eric Schwartzel, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you start noticing the Chinese influence on American films when you started to be The Wall Street Journal's reporter on the Hollywood industry?
It started in small ways. I joined the journal in 2013, and I would have this morning routine of checking the trade publications. And there would be these notices, you know, Chinese actress Fan Bingbing cast in a new X-Men movie, or this Chinese industrialist was financing a slate of films at Paramount. And it was these dribs and drabs. And I think there was a sense throughout Hollywood that this was China's turn at what they call dumb money, which is the trend of either business people from certain countries or just wealthy individuals coming to Hollywood with stars in their eyes and wanting to finance movie making. And at first, it seemed like this might be China's turn to lose its shirt in Hollywood. But then it became pretty clear that there was actually also a political motivation here and that China's government had broader ambitions than just merely the financial. And it seemed like there was a broader story to tell that it would explain why Chinese actresses were showing up in these Hollywood movies or why these scripts were being written for these unexpected detours to Shanghai.
So just give us a sense of what you think China's political motivation is.
I think since the start, as China has broadened its ambitions on the world stage and tried to become a bigger and bigger player in global politics, it has seen how culture can play a huge role in helping that effort. So I think China has seen how, for the past 100 years, Hollywood films helped sell America to the world. And it knows that if it wants to expand its reach, whether it's in parts of Asia or Africa or even within China, that culture, whether it's in the form of movies or TV shows or music, can be a complement to that effort. And I think what they're looking to do now is something of a soft power sequel to what Hollywood did for America in the 20th century.
So Chinese influence is especially noticeable in action films, franchise films, blockbusters of all sorts. That's where the big money is. So I want you to give us a tour of, you know, a recent or fairly recent movie in which you see a lot of Chinese influence, because I know you've been seeing a lot of movies looking for that influence.
That's right. I wear my X-ray goggles when I go to the movies now, and I can see the Chinese cell phone, you know, even if it's blurred in the frame. Because you're right, you'll start to see it everywhere. And I think there was this moment in Hollywood's relationship with China when this really took a turn. And the producers in Hollywood started to realize not only can we avoid certain topics to guarantee a movie's release in China, but we can also try to strategically appeal to Chinese audiences and therefore goose ticket sales there. So the one example I always go back to was released several years ago. It was the fourth installment of the Transformers franchise. And this movie became something of a case study in how Hollywood was trying to appeal to the Chinese audiences. Because the Transformers movies at this point had been doing better and better with each successive installment in the Chinese market, really grossing hundreds of millions of dollars in ticket sales. And so when the time came for production to start on the fourth installment, which was called Age of Extinction, they really threw everything against the wall. They held a reality show competition in which they cast four Chinese actors and actresses in cameo roles in the movie. They even filmed, I think, about a third of it in China. And then they also struck all these product placement deals that would suffuse the film with Chinese products, some of which make very little sense. So there's a scene in which the characters are in Chicago, and as they recover from the robot war, they have to raid a Chicago convenience store where they just happen to buy Chinese protein powder. There's another scene where an ATM has to be used in the middle of Texas. It happens to be a Chinese ATM. So really not a lot of logic behind these choices, but it became this example of how this Hollywood movie that is still really a distinctly Hollywood film, it stars Mark Wahlberg and Stanley Tucci, nonetheless was going to throw in what the producers called Chinese elements in an effort to appeal to Chinese audiences.
So did that Transformers film do well in China?
It was a massive success. And it ended up making more money than every previous installment. And I think critically for the producers at Paramount Pictures, which released the film, it helped them report really robust quarterly results. So it was an example of how a lot of studios started operating on this quarter-by-quarter basis because the studios became these smaller fish in these larger corporate ponds. In the case of Paramount, it's owned by Viacom, now Viacom CBS. This studio that was once this mighty enterprise here in Hollywood is actually a subdivision of this much larger corporate whole, and that makes it all the more important that they report really robust global grosses to the corporate gods.
So, you know, these deals between China and Hollywood, Hollywood stands to make money or stood to make money on those deals. For China, it was a way to get more Chinese elements into American films, but also it was good for the Chinese box office. China was making money from these films too. But so you gave the example of this Transformers movie where the studio really catered to China. It did well in China. Let's compare that to Spider-Man No Way Home, which has been the biggest success box office-wise in America during the pandemic era. How did it do in China? And I'll answer my question. It didn't do at all in China. Like, why hasn't it shown in China?
That's a, let's say, $400 million question right now because that's about how much money it probably could have expected to make in China. You're right. This new Spider-Man movie, which has all but saved American movie theaters, is exactly the kind of film that should sail onto Chinese screens with no problem. There's really no censorship issues, and it's just the kind of film that makes a lot of people in China happy, not just fans of Marvel and American superheroes, but also Chinese theater owners who also rely on these films to sell tickets and make money. And yet, nonetheless, Spider-Man was the fifth or sixth film released last year that did not get into China, that was not approved for release. And to be honest, there's a lot of uncertainty and anxiety here in Los Angeles right now because no one exactly knows why. There are a lot of theories, but no answers. It's not like Beijing sends a memo when authorities reject a film and say, here's why. So everyone has to kind of divine what the authorities in China are thinking. And right now, there are several theories. One is that China has been looking inward more and more over the past several years, and Chinese films have reflected that. Chinese films have been doing much better in recent years than they used to. It used to be no contest. American movies did far better than their Chinese counterparts. That's become less and less the case. The other theory is that with the recent Winter Olympics and with Xi Jinping's just longer-term consolidation of power, that the spigot of Western influence overall has been tightened. And one of the main ways of controlling that influence is letting very Western movies into the country.
Or not letting them into the country.
Exactly.
China used to keep out American films. The leadership in China wanted Chinese people to see basically Chinese propaganda films. That started to change in the 90s. Why did it start to change then?
It started in 1994, and a couple things were happening at the time. China's economy was modernizing and opening up to the world. This is a time when companies like Boeing were moving into China. And you're right that after the Cultural Revolution, Chinese movie theaters reopened, but they really struggled because really the only thing the government had to offer were these very medicinal, propagandistic films. And they were really the only show in town until things like television or even karaoke lounges gave people something a little bit more fun to do. And if movies were popular, it often was because they were pirated and available for sale on the city corner. So the theaters were really struggling. And in 1994, an executive who was stationed in the region for Warner Brothers suggested to a very prominent theater owner that Western movies might help the theaters recover. And so Warner Brothers sent the first American movie over, which was Harrison Ford's The Fugitive, to screen in a theater. And a contract was drawn up that only sent 13% of ticket sales back to Warner Brothers. So this was a really paltry amount. And despite having this massive population, the Chinese box office was still really small. I mean, I think The Fugitive made around $3 million, which is nothing to a studio as big as Warner Brothers, but was an absolute blockbuster in Chinese terms. And the Chinese audiences, who had essentially been shut off to Hollywood's influence in the 20th century, started to do what audiences around the world had done decades prior, is they flocked to the theater to see American films. And by the late 90s, only a handful of American movies were flowing into China, but nonetheless, they were causing these surges in box office sales.
I asked Eric Schwartzel about the standards American films have to meet before China will allow them to be shown.
There's a literal list of rules that the censors in Beijing use as something of a checklist. So when a movie has finished filming and is ready for release, a copy of it is sent to Beijing to the Ministry of Propaganda, where a collection of censors who tend to be, you know, a collection of state bureaucrats and even some film studies professors watch the movie. And obviously, anything that might concern Tibet or Chinese history or Mao is going to be off the table. But even a superhero movie might be watched for certain scenes that contain images or themes they don't want the Chinese people to see. And it ranges from the cosmetic to the thematic. So I'll give you an example. So in 2006, Mission Impossible 3 filmed some scenes in Shanghai that feature Tom Cruise running through the streets. And in the background, there is laundry drying on clotheslines from apartment buildings. And the Chinese authorities requested that that laundry be edited out of the frame because they thought it presented an image of China that was more backwards than they wanted the world to see. And then there are just deeper issues with some of the core tenets of Hollywood movie making. So, for example, there was a film that came out more than a decade and a half ago called In Good Company. And it's a pretty innocuous romantic comedy starring Topher Grace as this young guy who gets a job and displaces the older boss. And it seems like a pretty, you know, run-of-the-mill PG-13 family-friendly film. It nonetheless did not get into China. And at the time, the head of the Motion Picture Association started asking around in Beijing why that was the case. He couldn't understand why a movie that obviously was not nearly as politically charged as something like Kundun would not get into China. And the authorities said, well, no, it's a movie about the younger generation challenging the system and taking on the powers that be. And that's a theme that we cannot abide here in China. So you realize that not only do studio chiefs today have to watch a movie and realize and think about how every frame of China is scrutinized, but also think quite a bit about how core elements of American storytelling will be interpreted by censors in Beijing.
And the censors have some very ambiguous guidelines, things like displaying passive or negative outlooks on life is not something that happens in China. Chinese people don't participate in bad habits. China is a place where rape or murder do not occur in grisly detail. Or not shown in grisly detail. How does a movie maker determine what's a passive or a negative outlook according to Chinese censors, or participating in bad habits according to Chinese censors? And besides, franchise films are all about negative outlooks on life and bad habits and grisly rape and murder. I mean, let's be honest, that's what they are.
Often the distinction is where such bad things are happening. And as long as they're not happening in China,
I see.
It's kosher.
Oh, so okay.
So for example, the James Bond film Skyfall has a scene that I think no one who's familiar with James Bond would think twice about, in which James Bond is breaking into a building and has to shoot a security guard. It just so happens that the security guard he shoots in Skyfall is Chinese. That had to be removed because Chinese authorities worried that it made China look weak.
You know, Hollywood studios would not stand, I don't think, in this day and age for censorship like this from American censors. They wouldn't go back to the days of the Hays Code, I don't think. But they've been willing to do this for China?
Absolutely. I mean, the economics have made it something of a no-brainer because China's box office has grown as America's box office has flatlined. And this is even pre-COVID. And around 2008 or 2009, when studios started to wake up to how much money could be made at the Chinese box office, something else very important happened, which is that the DVD market collapsed. And it can be hard to remember this in an era where we're all streaming, but for many years, DVD sales, because they were so cheap to make and profitable to sell, really kept the lights on at a lot of studios. And so when the DVD market collapsed, studios were scrambling to find a way to make up that lost revenue when China entered the picture. So I think a lot of studio executives, if they were on the line, would say that they censor movies for all kinds of markets. They censor movies for airplanes. That it's a market reality they have to respond to. But what we've seen with China over the past decade is a scale of censorship that is unlike anything Hollywood's had to reckon with, and also a playbook of censorship that goes far beyond cutting a scene for a movie that before it goes into a certain country. I mean, China has made it clear that it wants to censor films that are being made in America and released around the world, not just movies that are being released into their home market.
Let's talk about a recent example of Chinese intervention in the American movie industry. And this is an example having to do with Star Wars: The Force Awakens. One of the stars of that film is the British-Nigerian actor John Boyega. And in the Chinese poster for that film, his image, even though he's one of the stars, is shrunk and kind of in the background. Tell us the story behind that.
That's right. It was something that fans noticed right away when the poster was released in China. Boyega's face was about as prominent as BB-8, the little circular droid in the film. And the reason why was because Disney executives in the Beijing office had redesigned the poster because they'd feared that Chinese audiences would be less receptive to a movie prominently featuring an actor of color than audiences elsewhere would be. And it was part of an effort that was really extensively trying to sell Star Wars to China overall. And the diversity of the cast of the new films was read as a risk in that effort. When Disney purchased Lucasfilm in 2012, one of the key elements of its business strategy was selling Star Wars to China. And the diversity of the new films, while cheered in America and other parts of the world, was read as a risk to that new audience.
it's just so interesting how studios can like really brag like, oh, we're becoming inclusive. We have a diverse cast. That's so great. And then in China, it's like, well, you know, kind of keep the black guy in the background because that's not going to go over well here.
You know, I think another example of that is what the studios have had to do when it comes to portrayals of homosexuality on screen. Another theme that Hollywood has told in some very prominent films over the past several years, but if you look to see how those movies are changed for Chinese audiences, it can feel very retrograde, very, very 1950s. I'll give you an example, which is the Queen film Bohemian Rhapsody, which came out several years ago. That movie was already criticized in the U.S. for sanitizing Freddie Mercury's homosexuality. But when the film was released in China, it all but shoved him back in the closet and didn't acknowledge much of his relationship with men. And even in the scene where he reveals he has AIDS, in some theaters in China, while he's saying that, the sound through the speakers just dropped out. And so audiences wouldn't even hear what he was saying. Something very similar happened with the movie Green Book, which has a scene in which the pianist played by Mahershala Ali is seen at a YMCA with a man, and it's PG, but it's clear that they had been caught in a shower together. Well, in China, when the movie was released, they cut that frame so that it's sharper on Mahershala Ali, and you don't see that there's another man there with him.
Well, this has been fascinating. I will start watching movies in a different way now. Eric Schwartzel, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much. And thank you for your book.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Eric Schwartzel is the author of the new book, Red Carpet: Hollywood, China, and the Battle for Cultural Supremacy. A new Batman movie opened in U.S. theaters Friday. It's scheduled for theatrical release in China on March 18th, marking the return of the Hollywood superhero movie to China. The film stars Robert Pattinson as the famous Gotham City vigilante and features Paul Dano as the Riddler, Colin Farrell as the Penguin, and Zoe Kravitz as Catwoman. Our film critic Justin Chang says that this three-hour crime epic plays more like a detective story than past Batman films. Here's his review.
Batman has had his ups and downs with the movies over the years. He started off on a high note with the gothic wit of Tim Burton, but crashed and burned in the hands of Joel Schumacher. He soared to new heights with Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, then took a nosedive with Zack Snyder's Batman vs. Superman: Dawn of Justice. Frankly, I wish the character would go away for a few years and take a well-earned batnap, but that's not the Batman way. Nor is it the way of a movie studio eager to keep milking one of its most successful comic book superheroes. And so now we have The Batman, a new movie clearly conceived in the somber, realistic Dark Knight mold, though this one may be even darker. Michael Giacchino's score is as ominous as a death march. Greg Fraser's images immerse us in a rain-pelted Gotham City of thick, sometimes impenetrable shadows. And Robert Pattinson plays the young billionaire Bruce Wayne as the most troubled of souls. He's still deeply scarred by the murders of his parents decades ago, which is what drives him to don his batsuit every night and strike fear in the hearts of criminals everywhere. As the film opens, Gotham City is being terrorized by the Riddler, a twisted puzzle master played by a convincingly unhinged Paul Dano. He fancies himself a kind of Avenger, brutally murdering members of the city's social, political, and financial elite, and exposing their corruption. His first victim is Gotham's mayor. At the funeral, Bruce is approached by Bella Real, played by Jamie Lawson, who had been running against the mayor in the upcoming election. Bruce is quiet and withdrawn. It's as if Batman has drained him so completely that he can barely function in public anymore.
Mr. Wayne, you know, you really could be doing more for this city. Your family has a history of philanthropy, but as far as I can tell, you're not doing anything. If I'm elected, I want to change that.
Thank you.
My God. I'm going to go pay my respects. Will you wait for me? I'm going to continue this.
The Riddler has been leaving cryptic messages for Batman at each murder scene. Those clues lead him deep into the heart of Gotham's criminal underworld, ruled by mobsters like Carmine Falcone, played by John Turturro, and his associate Oz, better known as the Penguin. The Penguin is, of course, one of Batman's iconic nemeses, but as played by Colin Farrell, unrecognizable under bulging prosthetics, he's surprisingly underutilized. He's basically a mafia functionary who turns out to have dangerously close ties to the police department. In this scene, Batman speaks with his close ally, Lieutenant Gordon, well played by Jeffrey Wright, and informs him that one of his cops is working for the Penguin.
Who's the mustache with the broken nose? It's Kinsey Narcotics. He's one of the guys I got into it with at the Iceberg Lounge. What are you saying, Kinsey? Moonlights for the Penguin? All right, Moonlights is a cop.
There are some impressive supporting performances from Andy Serkis as Bruce's loyal butler, Alfred, and Zoe Kravitz as the nimble thief Selina Kyle, a.k.a. Catwoman, who has her own mysterious designs on the Falcone crime ring. Kravitz and Pattinson have a playful romantic chemistry in their scenes together. But like so much else in this movie, the Batman-Catwoman dynamic feels like an overly familiar note. That's par for the course in blockbuster filmmaking, where popular characters get recycled every few years. But I had higher expectations for the Batman, especially since Matt Reeves' previous movie, War for the Planet of the Apes, was one of the best Hollywood action epics to come along in some time. Reeves and his co-writer, Peter Craig, have brought considerable craft and intelligence to bear on the story, which plays like a tribute to classic detective procedurals, and also David Fincher's serial killer thrillers, like Zodiac and Seven. The filmmakers unfold their labyrinth of a plot with great patience, maybe too much patience at nearly 3 hours. But the problem with the movie isn't that it's too long or too somber. As a great admirer of Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy, I have no problem with pulp that takes itself seriously. But those films also crackled with ingenuity and verve, and the grimness of the Batman feels self-conscious and monotonous by comparison. Nothing in the story about the moral rot at the heart of Gotham City, or the inner demons that Batman is wrestling with, feels novel enough to justify the movie's long, slow burn. There are a few gestures toward topicality, including an act of violence against an Asian man on a subway platform, and a mass attack by a group of gun-toting extremists. At one point, Catwoman makes a cutting remark to Batman about the corruption of rich white men, and the movie seems to be confronting Bruce Wayne with not just his trauma, but also his privilege. I do hope Pattinson gets more notes to play when this Batman gets its inevitable sequel. He's a terrific actor, even in a movie that feels less like a recharge than a retread.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed The Batman. The number of new COVID cases is in steep decline in many parts of the country, but we don't yet know how many of the people who've had COVID will develop long COVID with chronic symptoms that may include fatigue, shortness of breath, coughing, joint pain, muscle pain, chest pain, and problems with focus and memory. The attention researchers are devoting to long COVID may end up benefiting people with mysterious, hard-to-diagnose diseases, including Lyme disease and autoimmune diseases like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. Patients with these diseases have often been told it's all in their heads. My guest Megan O'Rourke has been writing about long COVID for The Atlantic and Scientific American. Her new book is about her own experiences with chronic illness. It started in the late 1990s, soon after graduating college. Her symptoms over the years have included extreme fatigue, brain fog, joint pain, nerve pain that felt like constant electric shocks, hives, fevers, and more. She's been diagnosed with Lyme disease and several autoimmune diseases and tried many different approaches to treating them. Her new book, The Invisible Kingdom, Reimagining Chronic Illness, is also a diagnosis of our medical system and how ill-equipped it is to deal with patients who are suffering with illnesses for which we may not even have names yet, let alone treatments. O'Rourke is a former fiction, nonfiction editor at The New Yorker, former culture and literary editor at Slate, and is now the editor of the Yale Review. Megan O'Rourke, welcome to Fresh Air. COVID has been triggering epic rates of long COVID, whose symptoms are very similar to autoimmune diseases. And long COVID seems to be related to immune dysregulation. Can you compare long COVID with the autoimmune diseases that you write about in your book that you've experienced? What do they have in common?
Absolutely. So long COVID is characterized by a wide variety of symptoms that persist long after the initial infection with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And those symptoms, you know, might include chest pain, but they also include so-called vague and subjective symptoms like brain fog or fatigue and roaming pain in the body. For some patients, these symptoms come and go a little bit. They are also hard to measure on certain kinds of conventional lab tests. And all of this puts pressure on patients who then have to testify to the reality of their own illness. In this way, it's quite similar to many of the autoimmune diseases and the other diseases I write about in my book, because these are diseases that we lack really good tools for measuring, especially in early states of the disease. They're diseases that can come and go. They're diseases that can be affected and worsened by stress. And they're diseases, therefore, that are often contested by medicine. You know, we can get into it further, but there's a lot we still don't know about what exactly long COVID is. And a lot of the researchers I've reported on have said to me, the term itself may be an umbrella term in the end that encompasses a few different kinds of conditions that we come to understand better. And in fact, one of those conditions may be autoimmune disease, right? We do have evidence that long COVID seems to be triggering pretty substantial rates of autoimmune disease in some patients who get COVID.
Because of long COVID, I think it's fair to say researchers are putting more time and energy and resources behind understanding these mysterious illnesses, because so many people have long COVID. So what is the latest researchers have discovered about possible causes of long COVID that might have impact on other chronic diseases?
There's a number of governing theories about what long COVID is, and they range from, you know, when we get sick, our immune system springs into action, right? Trying to get rid of the pathogens that have, you know, entered or even invaded, we might say, our body, and tries to push them out. And so one theory of long COVID has been that in some people, that immune response just doesn't turn off for a, you know, a wide variety of reasons. And so they keep getting damage to their body done by their own immune system, either an autoimmune process or inflammation. Just, we've all heard that term, right? There's also some evidence suggesting that in some parts of the body, fragments of the virus remain, or in other parts that the virus itself remains persisting and triggering ongoing immune action. A recent study found that there are some indicators that can tell us a little bit about who might be prone to get long COVID. One such indicator is the level of coronavirus RNA in your blood early on in the infection. So that tells us something about that term viral load we've all heard about. So if you have a high viral load early in your infection, even if your symptoms are mild, you might end up with long COVID. There's also evidence that some of these things called autoantibodies, which are the antibodies in autoimmune disease, these are antibodies that instead of attacking those pathogens that are coming into your body, actually end up mistakenly, mysteriously attacking your own tissue instead. Another factor is people who have reactivated Epstein-Barr virus, which many of us have had, but some of us have these episodes of reactivation. That can be a kind of a sign that you might develop long COVID. And another is the presence of type 2 diabetes.
Have you been reporting on long COVID because you know it's related to the problems that you and so many other people have had with chronic, often autoimmune diseases?
Absolutely. So, Terry, when the coronavirus pandemic came to the U.S., kind of the first big wave in March, it was in the U.S. before, but during that first wave, what kept me up at night as the coronavirus pandemic came to the United States was not just the wave of acute infections that were clearly coming, but also the prospect of a tremendous wave of chronic illness that would follow them. The research I had been doing already for 5 years had taught me that in many cases, infections can leave ongoing problems in a subset of patients in ways that we're just beginning in medical science to really research and understand. Many autoimmune diseases are triggered by viruses. In fact, it's the interaction of a virus or an infection with your own genetics can, in some cases, trigger conditions like lupus or multiple sclerosis, as we just found out in a big study. So I had been talking to virologists who, and researchers who work on the ways that Epstein-Barr creates all kinds of, you know, long conditions. And, you know, reading these early reports of the severity of the SARS-CoV-2 virus just had me worrying that a tremendous number of people were going to get sick and never get better. So I was kind of lurking on message boards and reading around from pretty much April of 2020 to see what I was seeing, and pretty quickly just started seeing these terrifying messages that reminded me so much of my own case, where people were saying, I just never got better. I got sick. I have brain fog. My energy is gone. I'm not the person I once was. And I read those with a chill of recognition.
You're right. You know, the stories we tell about illness usually have startling beginnings, like the fall at the supermarket, the lump discovered in the abdomen. But yours doesn't have one story like that. You have several ways of telling how your problems started. Would you describe a couple of those ways over the years?
Yeah, so my illness is hard to put a starting point to. There's a version in which I can say I had strange symptoms from when I was a young child. But one of the ways I can talk about it is that in the fall of 1997, not long after I had graduated from college, I was walking to work from my, you know, East Village apartment, you know, excited for my new life as a person in the city. And as I was walking down East 9th Street toward First Avenue, these terrible electric shocks came over my body. It was like someone was sticking tiny needles all over my legs and arms. And the sensation was so severe that if I didn't rub my legs, they would start spasming. And I had to stop and lean against a parking meter and just wait until this episode had passed some 15 minutes later. From then on, I started getting these electric shocks daily and having strange bouts of vertigo and fatigue and dizziness. And I never really got better. I sort of went up and down for years and had a roller coaster of different problems, abdominal pain, dizziness and fainting, joint pain, memory loss, incredible fatigue, hives, and then these very strange drenching night sweats that started after not long after 9/11. Anytime I went to a doctor, they would say, look, your labs look great. You're this relatively healthy young woman. Maybe you're just a little bit stressed. You have a really stressful job. And I kind of didn't ask too many more questions until I was in my 30s. And one day I was driving a colleague home from a Christmas party at Princeton, where we were then teaching. And this was someone I had known, you know, in New York for 15 years. We were colleagues. And it was really strange. We were driving past an exit and I looked over at him. And all of a sudden, I had no idea who he was. And I did know that I knew him, but I could not have told you his name. I could not have told you even in what capacity I knew him or how long or how I had met him. And so I kind of rattled, drove all the way home and actually remembered who he was at one point. Walked up the stairs to my apartment after parking and spoke to my partner. And I said, look, this just happened. Has something like this ever happened to you? And that was the moment where his face really got alarmed. And he said, no, I think, you know, something really is wrong. And that was the moment, I think, when I just really started to realize that I needed answers no matter what.
What kind of doc do you go to when so many parts of your body are affected? You can go to your internist. It's hard to figure out what specialist to go to, because is it a nerve specialist? Is it a joint specialist? Is it, you know, a memory specialist? Like, who do you, what were some of the dilemmas you faced about even figuring out where to seek help?
I was so naive, Terry. I didn't know really that you needed to even go to specialists. Like, I just didn't, I was young. I just really didn't understand very much. And so it took a long time to figure out that I should keep asking questions and asked to be referred to specialists. And when I did finally figure that out, I started to see, just ask around, right? And then in the way one does, someone recommends somebody, you go see them. I ended up seeing a really tremendous doctor who specializes in women's health, who was the first to take my history and listen to me and say, I think you really do have an autoimmune disease. But by the time she diagnosed me, there were so many things going wrong in my body that I ended up seeing, I think, 9 different specialists all to sort of attack different problems I was having, right? A neurologist, a dermatologist, an immunologist. And, you know, none of these doctors were really speaking to each other or communicating. And they really were just looking at the piece that fell under their jurisdiction. So there was no one stepping back and taking a look at my health as a whole and saying, what's wrong with this person? She has so many seemingly different symptoms. Is there a way in which they might be connected?
So when you go to a dermatologist and complain about your hives, would you tell them about the brain fog and other issues that you were having, or did you withhold that information, or were they just dismissive and said, you know, like, that's not my field, I can't help you with that?
I think in a lot of cases I didn't tell them just because it didn't come up, right? The basic building block of modern medicine in America are these 15-minute doctor's appointments, right? And so you go in and that person asks you a few questions and it just didn't even maybe come up that all this other stuff was going on. Why would I tell my dermatologist I had night sweats? Over time, as I got sicker and more practiced and more assertive about my need for answers, I would sometimes tell a doctor, look, here's this full array of problems that I'm having. And I just remember vividly watching one doctor's face change, right, as my list of symptoms got longer. And I just felt him back away. This was a doctor I didn't know very well that I'd been referred to. I just saw him think, oh, this is a problem patient, a so-called problem patient, right? This is a person who is invested in being sick. I could just feel his thoughts across the room. And after that, I have to tell you, I really did start picking and choosing what I told doctors because I really wanted to get them on my side. I really wanted them to be invested in helping me. And I had come to think that if I told them the full extent of what was going on with me, they might think I was a hypochondriac.
So you went to one doctor who said, your symptoms are very real, but that doesn't mean we know how to cure you. And that was so helpful to you. Why did you find that so useful, even though she didn't have a solution?
Yeah, this was my neurologist. She just was incredibly kind. She's very smart. She looked at me and said, I completely believe something is going on with you. We just don't know what it is, and we may not be able to help you. And the recognition of that changed everything for me because I went from trying to get someone else to believe in what I was saying to feeling that I had an ally who did believe me. And that brought hope with it. And I think it brought the comfort of being seen.
So tell us what diseases you've been diagnosed with and the ones that turned out to be real.
Over time, I was eventually diagnosed with something called autoimmune thyroiditis, which is thyroid disease that's caused by autoimmune processes in your body, with your body attacking your thyroid. I was diagnosed with Lyme disease that had gone missed for probably 15 years. And I was ultimately also diagnosed with a genetic condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a group of connective tissue disorders. You know, we all think of collagen as, we know collagen from skincare products, right? And sort of flexible skin. Well, in Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, your collagen is too fragile, so it tears really easily and your veins don't constrict properly. And so as a result, I also have dysautonomia, which is an autonomic nervous system disorder that causes, in my case, fainting and dizziness and can contribute to brain fog.
So, you know, when we talk about autoimmune diseases, the basic way of describing that is that your immune system attacks healthy tissues instead of attacking germs. What triggers that kind of response where your immune system attacks healthy tissues, leading to the kinds of disorders you've described?
Researchers are still trying to answer that question, but we have a host of possible answers. One thing we know is that infections can trigger that response in a subset of patients who are just genetically susceptible, right? You have a certain mutation and the virus comes in and then it can lead to or help contribute to autoimmune disease. One of the mysteries of autoimmune diseases is that they're rising at epidemic rates in Western countries. So one of the things that researchers suspect is that something in our environment is changing our immune systems. That could be anything from the vast new number of chemicals to changes in our food system and how we eat and how that impacts our microbiome. It could involve a whole host of things, but things like changes in your microbiome, stress is a major cause. We have studies that suggest having what's called an adverse childhood event, a significant childhood trauma, can increase your risk of autoimmune disease later in life. So, you know, there's a lot of mystery still here, but what's really clear is that something in the environment is changing and contributing to it.
Megan O'Rourke, thank you so much for talking with us. And I wish you long periods of good health.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Megan O'Rourke is the author of the new book, Invisible Kingdom, Reimagining Chronic Illness. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering today from Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brugger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.